Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Global Gaming Business Podcast. As always, I am your host, Jess Marquez, and our guest today is Paul Spears Hernandez, owner and founder of Steinbeck Communications and the Red Wagon Institute, to talk about his journey to becoming a leading communications and organizational expert and how his companies help shape the industry of both today and tomorrow. There are few figures in the gaming industry whose presence and mentorship is as widely felt as Paul Spears Hernandez, founder of Steinbeck Communications and the Red Wagon Institute. Through these ventures, Spears Hernandez plays a big role in helping companies craft their communication strategies while also training employees from the front line to the C-suite to become better leaders and teammates. He and I spoke remotely in June. Paul, thank you so much for joining me today. It is a Friday today. It's a beautiful day, and it's great to talk to you as always. How are you doing today?
Thanks, brother. It's good to see you. I'm awesome. It's a great Friday here in Las Vegas, so every day is a great day.
You know, it's interesting. So for anybody who may not be familiar, you are a communications and leadership extraordinaire. You are the owner and founder of Steinbeck Communications as well as the Red Wagon Institute, excuse me, both of which are big pillars in the gaming industry. But it's interesting, I was thinking before we came on here, about how many times, how often we've talked to each other off the air, and usually in the context of other people, right? We're usually searching around for your various clients and such and trying to fill stories and stuff like that. But today it is all about you, the man, yourself. I want to hear all about you, your story, and everything you got going on. So this is really fun. We've known each other for years. I've never really got to sit down and, like I said, do this one-on-one like this. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Because we're always running around. We're always running around at trade shows or this and that and that and this. So who has time to sit down and talk? So I'm happy to have the chance to do that finally, Jess.
Too true, too true. So as I say, I know you from my experience in the industry, which is very short, less than 5 years. So I know the version of Paul that is this very experienced, you know, industry veteran, so on and so forth. But I want to go behind the curtain, take me back a little bit. Give me a little bit of the Paul Spears Hernandez origin story. Obviously, you don't have to go line by line, sentence by sentence, but kind of how, give me some of the experiences that led to you and I being here today.
Well, you know, what's funny is I grew up in Salt Lake and I did my undergrad at Southern Utah, and I'd applied to 5 different grad programs, and I didn't really care which one I went to. Honestly, they all had equal bearings and some interesting things about them. And I was like, well, I'm going to go who pays me the most to go to school, because you have to be able to afford grad school, as it turns out.
Sure.
And literally what happened was I went down stairs on my way out of my apartment to turn my keys. I checked the mailbox the last time, and there was a letter from UNLV. And that's how I came to Vegas. And that's where I was supposed to be here for 1 year. And 35 years later, I'm still here. So it was funny because in our grad office, we were on the 4th floor of this building. There was, I think, 8 or 10 of us in this room that shared one office, you can imagine. And we could see the quad from outside our window, and Bill Clinton was campaigning for president, and he came and spoke in the quad one day. So we're looking down our window like, who's this dude from Arkansas running for president? And then, you know, the rest is history. So that's how long I've been in Las Vegas. And what's funny is I met this hilarious, crazy, awesome, insightful, fun person named Patty Coley, and we've been best friends ever since. And she has a lot to do with why you and I are talking together today.
So it's interesting. I feel like the vast majority, probably like 90% or above, of the people who I ask that question of, like, how'd you get here? How'd you get into gaming? It's some form of some accident or other. There's very few. Maybe there's like some people whose parents grew up in the industry and they did too, but those are very few. And one thing that's interesting about what you said is that coming from Utah, you quite literally came from the state with zero gaming to the state with all the gaming. So coming to UNLV was the, you know, the foray into the gaming industry after that, was that kind of like a natural progression, or was that in and of itself kind of a, you know, also a happy accident?
It was a happy accident, actually, because my friend Patty, she was a year ahead of me. So she left and went over to Excalibur as the publicist. And as my time was winding down, I went and worked on a governor's campaign. And as that was winding down, she called me. She goes, look, I'm getting promoted to be in the advertising manager. I got to fill this position. Why don't you come work at the castle? And I was like, I've never worked in a castle before. Okay, let's go work in a castle. And that's literally how it turned out. And it's funny because you're right, Jess. Like, this whole entire industry is like one big RNG. Like, it's a pull of the handle, and this is where you sort of end up landing. Like, I don't know your origin story exactly. However, you probably had a little bit of a dice roll or a slot handle pull, and here you are at GGB 5 years later. And you're right that it's so everyone's story. You do meet those unicorns where it's like, wow, your grandfather was in gaming too. However, it's, oh, I will tell you that fun story. So one day we were in, I don't know if I can say this. I think I can. One day when I was over at Excalibur, our boss had been promoted to the first corporate VP position or all of Circus Enterprises, if that doesn't date it. And I got to go in Bill Bennett's old office, and they're like, would you like to sit in his chair? And I'm like, oh my God. I mean, it's like, that's a big freaking deal. So I'm like, sitting in Bill Bennett's chair, and just like that rush of history is sort of all around. And it was fascinating. It was one of the coolest things I've got to do. I'm like, this is where so much history happened, was right in this chair, and I get this chance to sit at this desk and breathe it in for a second. It was amazing. So cool.
So if we kind of continue on the lineage, so you go from UNLV to Excalibur or MGM. Was it MGM back? I'm assuming it was still a
It MGM was property? Circus Enterprises, and then it became MGM. Yeah.
So what then, how did you transition over to Steinbeck, which was eventually the communications company that you founded, I believe, over 20 years ago at this point, correct?
Yeah, it's been a good long time. So we had an ad agency that we used at Excalibur, and they recruited me over to join their team. And people will know this name. Tom Neiman was who actually recruited me over. Who's a freaking legend in the gaming industry. And to get a chance to work with him directly was an opportunity I wasn't going to pass up. And so we went over to an ad agency for a good 4 years. And then I started my own thing and been doing it ever since. And it's been great. You know, I mean, the communication side, it's actually what I went to school for, which is rare. People who go to school for marketing and PR, get a job and stay in the job in that industry is kind of a little bit rare. I've been one of those lucky people who's been able to do that for a good long time.
So one thing I've always been curious about, I've never asked you this before, but what is the inspiration behind Steinbeck? Because I'm a big reader and I'm a big John Steinbeck fan. He's one of my favorite authors. Is that the connection, or is there something else that I'm missing?
That is the connection. It's okay. My middle name, as it turns out.
Nice. Okay.
And, so when my mom was pregnant with me, she was reading a lot of Paul Harvey and a lot of John Steinbeck. And I, you know, I could have been named Harvey John, which probably wouldn't have fit as well as, so I ended up being Paul Steinbeck. And then when I started the company, I was like, well, we really want to have old fashioned customer service in this new world. And so the name just sort of fit. You know, we went through all sorts of random nonsense names, and me and a group of my friends were like throwing darts at the wall, and we all sort of landed on this one as that really is a brand. And what's funny is I'm such a film noir fan that we've embraced that as our brand. Like, that's just sort of the era that we sort of live in that brand. And it's been fun.
So staying on Steinbeck, we're going to obviously get to Red Wagon and kind of the intersection of the two in a little bit, but staying on Steinbeck, cause that was the first company that you founded and, for several years, what has been the kind of the evolution there in terms of, you know, your client base, kind of your team, your experience? Like, how would you kind of synthesize, what are some of the key takeaways from your Steinbeck journey over the last two plus decades now?
Well, you know, I love my people in PR. And what's funny is I was going to be a lawyer for a Japanese firm doing corporate law, working out of the Trade Center in New York City. Like, I had it all figured out. I took my first law class, and I'm like, I do not believe enough in the First Amendment to defend someone I know is guilty. I took my first Japanese class. It's when I found out I was dyslexic. And so that didn't work out. Then I took my first PR class. I'm like, oh my God, these are my people. That being said, I love my people, right? And one thing that as a personal pet peeve is when marketing or communications firms say, oh, we specialize in, and then they give you a laundry list. Like, well, you don't specialize in anything. Like, you might generalize in all sorts of stuff. You don't specialize in anything. So that was one of the decisions we made really early on. We're going to specialize in gaming, and that's what we're going to do. And when I, you know, I came from an operator world at Excalibur and Luxor and Mandalay, and so it was natural to do some operator clients for a while. And then gradually we moved in strictly to doing B2B for suppliers. And that's been the niche. It's fortunate that I have a strong operator background because I get where those two things need to come together. Like the suppliers need to do this, and the operators do this, and the operators need the suppliers to do this. So we have a very unique in-depth understanding of where those worlds intersect. And that's how, that's our specialty ever since we first started was, we're in gaming, this is what we do. And, you know, I had a client I was on the phone with earlier today, and they were needing some advice. And she actually said to me, she goes, I'm really glad that you're on our team because I wouldn't have gotten this good advice from probably anybody else. Now, that's a nice thing to say. You know, I don't know that it's necessarily the case or not. However, it was good to hear on a Friday, you know.
So it's interesting. So you kind of, you started, you came to Nevada kind of by accident. You started in the industry kind of by accident, but you stayed in the industry for a very specific purpose, as you said. And the supplier side, as you mentioned, I think is one of the more interesting and kind of maybe obviously less well-known, less public-facing sectors of the industry, but still incredibly important and still just as valuable, if not more valuable, than any other sector. And as I understand, you know, you have, you're very involved, you know, you do a lot of work with groups like AGEM, Global Gaming Women, and others. Can you kind of talk about those kind of industry B2B groups?
Yeah, what's fun about us is we do a lot of B2B work with suppliers as far as like people like Aristocrat and JCM, and then with regulatory agencies with GLI, and then with groups that benefit the industry in different ways. So like with AGEM and GGW, for example. And I love it. It's been really fun. It's that I get to see the whole world of gaming, how it all comes together, right? And to be involved in moving that forward with those various groups. And it's not that they're disparate. It's not like they all don't have the same needs. It's just they have different needs, all towards the same goal. And that's been fascinating. I've loved every second, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I got to meet Adam West, man. Like, that was probably the coolest thing maybe ever. Like, there's a couple of cool things I've got to do in my life. Meeting Adam West was right freaking up there, man. Like, that was just cool. Been on stage with the Blue Man Group, watched, you know, looked down on the top of the pyramid out at the rest of the world. And not a lot of people get to do those things. However, meeting Adam West was right up there.
But, you know, it's interesting. You know, you get to do a lot of cool things, meet a lot of cool people, and you in turn help me in my line of work as a journalist do the same thing. I get introduced to a lot of people. I get introduced to a lot of cool events, largely due to the work that you and others do. So thanks
Jess, you really hit on it. Like, my job is to help you do your job. And if I make that difficult, I am not doing my job today. And sometimes, you know, sometimes clients will not, they'll have a direction they want to go in, and you have to be the facilitator between helping that win-win happen. Sometimes it's like a constant negotiation. Other times it's really seamless, or sometimes it's a little bit of a negotiation. However, I view my job as helping journalists do their job. And whoever that is, and we deal with folks all over the world in all sorts of different mediums. And so if I'm making someone like you have a difficult time at your job, I'm not doing what I need to do correctly or successfully. So anything that, you know, I ran into, I was with, years ago, I was in Congressman Shelley Berkeley's office. And I was talking with her. She's a fascinating character. She's been in Vegas forever. She's really interesting, a lot of ways to stay. And she said, our philosophy is really simple. If someone comes to us with a problem, we can help, then we help. And I've adopted that. It was really early on in my career, and I've adopted that as a philosophy. So if we can help a journalist, we're going to help a journalist. That's period, full stop. That's what we do.
Well, not that you needed any more testimonials or you know, use cases, but for anyone listening, I will give you mine right here in front of everyone. So, if we move on now to kind of the more of the Red Wagon side, yeah. That, as far as I understand, came together about maybe a little bit less than 10 years ago, 8 years ago, if I have that correctly. Tell me about what led to that and kind of what your role is there.
Well, it was just about 8 or 9 years ago. And what was funny is ever since I was a little kid at Excalibur doing my internal comms job, my philosophy was really, really simple, that employees have to be the first audience in all communications. And I still believe that in the Steinbeck side, because let's be very clear, if your employees ain't buying what you're selling, ain't nobody else buying it either.
Sure.
So you have to consider, of all the audiences you're dealing with, you have to consider your employee audience first. So as a marketer, I really, really need all of the employees of the companies that we're marketing to fulfill on the brand promise that we're creating in marketing. So it was a very natural bridge where employees need to be your first audience, and I need employees to be the brand ambassadors to create this training program that helps facilitate that. And when everyone is a leader, then all of that falls into place, where the employees understand the mission and the goal and the communication and the importance of successfully delivering that. And then customers can also have a enjoyable experience by the people who are delivering that. So it all just came together, and it makes a lot of sense for me, that intersection of, oh, okay, I get how this works from this angle, and I get how this works from this angle. So let's make that happen for you.
So that's interesting. And your guys' philosophy, or at least the philosophy that you say of kind of everybody needing to be a leader from the front line to the CEO, that's very interesting to me, because I think there are a million different schools of thought, or there's a million different kind of ways to categorize or to try to, improve performance or improve leadership, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there might be some group of people who say, well, in order for a team to succeed, everyone's got to fulfill their role, right? So the leader has to be the leader, and whoever, even if you are a lower level employee, you have to do that to the best of your ability, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea that everyone needs to be a leader, I think, is very interesting. Could you kind of like go a little bit deeper on that, or kind of what exactly does that mean to you in the context of, say, one of your clients, like a gaming client, for example?
Yeah, sure. So it's a great question. And the answer to what you just said is yes and.
Sure.
So everyone needs to be a leader, meaning that everyone needs to have the leadership skills to be the very best that they can be in whatever it is that they're doing. So if I'm a GRA, or if I'm the front desk attendant, or if I am supervising 700 people, I need me as the head of the company, I need every single person to be the very best that they can be, and I need them to be able to lead in that area. I need them to be the leading person in what they do in that area. That's very important. While at the same time, you need to fulfill on the role that you have, right? Those aren't two different things. They really go together. Because if I understand my role and I'm going to be the best leader that I can in that role, then that's where the magic happens. So, and there's other approaches to this where, no, leadership is for a select people and we're going to just focus on those people. I completely disagree with that. You have to have everyone understand what leadership is so that they can fulfill on that leadership call when the time comes. I'll give you a perfect example. So we went to, we were with a client years ago on a team building and also training instructional basis. And we went to an escape room, and that's the greatest like offsite training program ever for teams, because all the personality types show up. It all just sort of happens. You can really debrief in a fantastic way. And one of the questions that we ask in training class in any given process is, all right, who's the leader of this process? And so I was with this group, and they'd been fumbling around for about 15 minutes. And I said, okay, well, you're kind of in chaos right now. Who's the leader? And they all turned to the person who was their boss. And I said, okay, so how come you're the leader here today? Have you done this before? She goes, no, I'm completely lost. I've never done this before. Let me ask, has anyone else been in an escape room before? And one person's hand shot up. She's like, oh, I do them all the time. And she said, well, then how come you're not the leader today? She goes, well, because you have the title. And therein lies exactly what we're talking about, is when everyone understands that they get to be the leader. So whenever that situation arises, when I don't have the title, I have the experience, though, I'm not afraid to raise my hand and go, I got it. I'm the leader today. we're going this way because I've done this before. And in about 15 minutes, they'd solve the escape room. And in 15 minutes, they hadn't got past room one. So it just makes all the difference in the world when everyone has that skill set and the willingness and the ability and the permission to lead. It makes all the difference in a company.
That's a great example. And I think that's a great way of putting it. And I think I definitely understand more of what you mean by that kind of thought process. And, you know, another thing I wanted to ask about is that you talked to me before about kind of the intentionality and consistency of leadership training and why, you know, those two things are so important. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you used an example of like buying a house and then doing no renovations or no up maintenance, right? So kind of talk to me about that side of things.
Yeah. So we look at leadership as an infrastructure. So as a company, you're somewhere. Whether you're working from home or whether you're in a building, you're working from somewhere. And that somewhere has an infrastructure to it. And no one is going to buy or rent a building and then that's the end of it. Like, you have to have the floors clean. You have to do basic maintenance. Like, you have to empty the trash and clean floors. Eventually, you're going to need a new roof or an air conditioner. And it's the upkeep along the way that makes those processes much easier. You ignore your air conditioning in Vegas. Every 3 years, you're putting in a new $20,000 system for a very small house.
Sure.
If you do that monthly upkeep, however, you're going to get 20 years out of that. It's the same thing with people. I just don't understand the philosophy of just hire people and let them go. Let them do their thing. Well, hire people and let them do good work, while at the same time, you need to invest in that infrastructure of leadership continually to ensure that communication is happening correctly, that teams are happening correctly, that people understand their roles, that people are being informed about decisions, and that everyone still has a willingness and ability and permission to lead. And when you just leave things to be, that's when silos get created, fractures created, and ultimately those cracks that could have been fixed with some scotch tape and some little bit of plaster are now chasms that require much greater lift of infrastructure. So we're happy to help in both cases. It's just our philosophy is that continual investment in leadership is going to save you from those giant cracks and silos. And, you know, silos happen instantly. And people don't really know that they're happening unless they're trained how to recognize them. And then a year later, you know, there's just a complete lack of trust. And marketing doesn't trust sales. And sales doesn't trust fulfillment. And fulfillment doesn't know what in the world our D&D does. And no one's talking. Everyone thinks it's everyone else's fault and problem. And that's really, really bad for your customers. And that's really, really bad for your bottom line. So that simple continual investment in leadership and other type, you know, leadership and communication training will help your bottom line exponentially. The ROI is untold on that because it is so big.
So that's interesting. And I don't know why, but it's leading me down this kind of this certain path. And I want to ask this question in a way that makes sense, or kind of, you know, when we talk about good and bad times, right? And obviously you being a in an industry like communications and leadership, where your clients are, you have to be with your clients through good and bad, right? And there's going to be bad. And so if you, at this point in your career, with all the, you know, the experiences that you've had and the kind of the people that you've seen and helped and everything like that, what is generally your first reaction, or what do you think is a good first step in terms of, like, if a company comes to you and says, hey, look, we would like some help with our communications. We just feel like for whatever reason it may be for them, it's just not going well, or it's just bad. Mm-hmm. Or conversely, if they say, hey, we've gone through some leadership changes, the morale is very low, we don't think our employees are very engaged, et cetera, et cetera. If somebody comes to you with a problem, what do you generally think is a good first step in those instances where you're needing to help and intervene and help turn somebody around, so to speak?
There's a short answer and a long answer. The longer answer is we'll need to go in and do an assessment and find out exactly where the shortcomings are, and we'll develop a plan to help you through that.
Sure.
The very, very short answer is stop saying can't. Honest to God, people do really weird things. They say try and but and can't all the time. And those three words are killers, and they make a sentence. Well, I try, but I can't. Like, really? Like, you're going to try to call somebody back? I just don't get it. I mean, Yoda had it for us. Like, we all say Empire Strikes Back when we were eight, and it made perfect sense. Do or do not, there is no try. And then as we get older, we embrace that as a philosophy. Like, well, I'll try to do this. You're not going to try to do anything. You're going to do it or you're not. But is another one. Like, stop saying but to people. Like, oh, I like that, but. Well, give people your and instead of your but. Like, no one wants your but. Sorry about it. No one wants your but. And it's a conversation killer. You're going this way, and then you go back that way, and they're still going that way. It's just ridiculous. Can't, though, man. That's the absolute killer. When you start saying can't to people, they start saying it to themselves, and then ultimately to your customers, it all becomes about what you as your company can't do for people instead of focusing on the can of things. I mean, we talked to one sales group and about the real power that there is in can. And they put a swear jar on their boss's desk, and they had a fee, and every time somebody said can't for a week, they had to put money in the swear, and of course it filled up in a day, and they had to get another one. And in a week's time, people had stopped saying can't. And this is real. This is a real story, Jess. It sounds crazy, and it's 100% real. In 6 weeks, the only change they made was they stopped saying can't, and their closings increased by 285% in 6 weeks. So if I were to give anybody just the short answer of what you need to go stop doing today is stop saying try but can't and start focusing on can and will, and it will make a huge difference. Home, work, community. Just imagine. So for example, like, yeah, I live in a place where the traffic is not what it used to be. And I just sometimes feel like people are stuck in what can't happen. Oh, we can't fix the freeways. You know, we can't fix the roads. Well, you're right. As opposed to, we can fix this. Let's find ways to make it happen. And the brain follows that because your brain is programmed to live in can't. You live in 20% of brain function all the time with that. And when you start saying, yeah, we can do this, your brain lights up and you open up 80% more of your brain capacity and you find ways to make it happen. So that's the short answer, man. Stop saying can't, like today, seriously. I'm super passionate about it. Can you tell? Like, it's nothing I'm passionate about at all.
No, that's what I love about it. I love the energy, and I think that's what all of your clients, certainly the clients whom you're referencing now, I'm sure would agree. Is there an answer then? It's interesting. If we look at it from the other side of the coin then quickly, and maybe there isn't, I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of going here, but conversely, would you say something to like a company, maybe you've been working with a company for a while and things are going really well. You say, hey, like we've really turned things around, like X, Y, and Z has changed, you know, in this time and like things are going really well. How do you keep that momentum? How do you make sure that, you know, or try your best to put things in place to keep that momentum going and keep the good times rolling? Is there a sense there?
Celebrate your success.
Sure.
Oftentimes people don't stop to do that. They are successful and they don't take a minute to celebrate that success and to also analyze like what is working, what isn't, and why is working, why it isn't. So let's keep doing what's working and then continue to tweak the things that aren't. And that's where you get into that maintenance, whether it's a, you know, change your air filters every month and then you don't have to get a new air conditioner every 3 years. It's that same idea where figure out what worked in your what worked and keep doing it and celebrate your successes. It's interesting because it's interesting and it's frustrating because so few people take the time to celebrate their success. I'll give you an example. So years ago, I was in a sales meeting because this team needed a little bit of help and they had this big contest amongst their 20 or so reps. And oh God, I can barely tell the story. It's so painful. So this guy won and it was a big deal. And he won like, you know, $5,000 or whatever it was at the time. And the reaction from the boss was, so Jimmy won the sales thing. Good for him. And this kid was so excited when he was announced as the winner. And then it just deflated and the whole room was like, oh, well, good for him. Well, by the way, that sales leader was gone 3 months later. And it was probably the best thing that could have happened. So just take a minute to think of the difference was like Jimmy won and here's what happened and here's the Jimmy and, you know, celebrate that in the moment with that kid would have made all the difference. Because by the way, he left first. And then the boss left shortly thereafter. So here's their top performer who left. Celebrate your successes, folks.
So I am actually going to take you up on that, and I am going to celebrate you because I want to go from, so we've had a very general, very general discussion, and I want to go to something specific now in terms of celebrating success. I know you were recently on a panel at the Indian Gaming Trade Show in the spring that I understand what I was actually unable to go. I will disclose, unfortunately, I was not there to see it, but
that's okay.
I have heard that your panel on training the next generation of leaders went very well, so well, in fact, that they are actually asking you to recreate it and republish it, as I understand. So could you please talk about that for a second?
Yeah, thanks. This is something I'm super proud of. So I'm super passionate about tribal gaming and about Native people. It's just it's a real, true, honest passion of mine. And I was thinking a lot about it where, you know, there less than 1% of the current U.S. Congress is Native. Less than 1%. So that means less than 1% of the voices heard every day in that building are Native. Well, that's, we need to change that. So I got to thinking, well, what do we need to do? Well, what we need to do is we need to inspire that next generation of leaders. So when you see that 15-year-old kid walking across a reservation, if we do our jobs right, in 10 years that kid's running for Congress, and in 15 years they're running for Senate, and in 20 years they're running for president, because that's the timeline. So how do we do that? How do we train the next generation of leaders? And, you know, I was floored at the response we got. We were able to get Francis Alvarez and Richard Armstrong and Kelly Weaver and Les Stanley to join this panel. And your listeners are going to absolutely recognize those names like this. They're ridiculously incredible leaders who I just stand in awe of all the time. So to have them all in one room on one panel talking about how we train the next generation of leaders was amazing. And then what was interesting, Jess, is I had sort of pictured like the 15-year-old in my head, like that's who we're targeting. And as we talked, the conversation turned to, well, yes, and we also, you know, the current generation of tribal gaming leaders who built this industry from the 90s to now, you know, they're not far from retirement. So we need to start looking at who's next. Who are the 25-year-olds that we have on our staff now who need to be trained to be the general manager of these properties and also to head some of these organizations? Because, you know, people do retire over time just because that's what we're all working for. And it was a fascinating discussion of what we need to do. And what was really interesting to me was there's many key points that really lit people up. One was providing intentional exposure, not just exposure, really intentional, thoughtful exposure to people. And the other one that there's so many, it's hard to narrow it down. Another one that really struck me, though, is we have to learn to listen to this next generation. And when we think about whether they're 15 or whether they're 25, when we're of a certain age as I am, it's easy to not listen. And they have a lot of interesting things to say. And that's where that, you know, if you're going to train the next generation, you have to listen and meet them where they are, was the third point, meet them where they are and use the technology that they use to help them learn and communicate. And it was a fascinating discussion. I was so honored to bring it forward. I think it's the first time that conversation had happened at an IGA show. And so we just we recreated that. And you can find it on my LinkedIn. We're going to put it on our website. It's a fascinating, fascinating listen with these leaders that are just incredibly insightful. And by the way, really frank. Like I asked them who was their leadership inspiration, and the stories that they told were so blunt and so frank that it was kind of gobsmacking in all the right ways, where they're willing to be vulnerable and show why they became the leaders that they did. And it's a fascinating listen. Way more fascinating than just me talking.
Definitely. Well, obviously, all of our listeners should go and find that. You said it's on you have it on your LinkedIn or it's on your website?
Yes, it's on Red Wagon's LinkedIn. It's on my personal LinkedIn. And then it's also on pechanga.net. You can find it there as well.
Sure. This has been so much fun. I've had such a great time. I want to get you out of here on one more, if I may.
Yes, sir.
And this is very broad. You can take this, obviously, any way you like. But you, based on our conversations and what I know about you, strike me as a very forward thinker, very kind of always looking ahead. What is one thing that excites you about the future of your journey, Steinbeck/Red Wagon? This could be something in terms of like in the immediate term, like in the next year, in the next few months or something. This could be a very long-term overarching goal in the next 5 to 10 years. You can really take it whichever way you want. What's one thing that excites Paul Spears Hernandez moving forward?
The next class. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why briefly, because I know we're running out of time. When we're in a training class, over the course of 2 half days or a full day, I get to literally watch people transform in front of me. They sit taller, their countenance changes. You can literally watch the physical manifestation of their confidence increasing. And that's what we're here to do. Like whether on the Steinbeck side or on the Red Wagon side, we're here to do one thing, and that's to help. That's what it all comes down to, is we're here to help. And it's incredible to watch people grow so instantly in a classroom setting. And, you know, a lot of the stuff we teach is hard. It's hard to go through. And a lot of it doesn't sink in right away. So we call them way homers, because you're going to get it on the way home. And sometimes that takes 2 days, and sometimes it takes a little bit longer. And I had one former student send me a photograph from Washington, D.C. It said Sawabona. It was etched in glass. It's one of the concepts we teach, which means I see you. And I don't know whose number it was. It was randomly I get this picture. She goes, hey, it's me, and I'm in Washington, D.C., and I saw this and thought of you. So we had a conversation, and she said, look, I got to tell you, man, I left your class thinking it was a bunch of touchy-feely, hokey crap. And I was sitting at a stoplight 6 months later, and everything clicked. She had a way homer of epic proportion. She goes, I want you to know, I pulled up my book, I did my 5-year plan, and I've accomplished everything on that list in 4 years and 3 months, except having a second baby and I'm 7 months pregnant.
Nice.
And those are those moments. It's like, you know, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So that's a long term and also a short term. You know what I mean? Like in short term, you see people grow.
Sure.
And then the long term, you know, 5 years later, this person is, you know, the head of an entire country, so a division of her company. So that's what's exciting to me. I love it.
That's beautiful, and I'm sure what's even more beautiful is the fact that it's I'm sure it's only just one of many innumerable experiences like that and people like that. So again, this has been so much fun, Paul. Thank you so much. Where can people find you if they want to reach out and learn more about you? How can they get in touch?
Yeah, you can SteinbeckCommunications.com, RedWagonInstitute.com. Find me on LinkedIn. DM me. I'm always good to respond. You can call me, email me, whatever you need to talk about. We're here to do one thing, and that's help. So let us know how we can help you.
Awesome. Thanks again, Paul, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Jess. This has been awesome. You're amazing. Thanks so much for taking the time. Thanks, everybody.
We thank you for joining us on this episode of the Global Gaming Business Podcast. To learn more about Paul Steinbeck, Red Wagon, and all things gaming, head to ggbmagazine.com. Don't miss an episode of the GGB Podcast by subscribing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.